From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, in for Marty Moscowain. If you are accused of a crime and you can't afford legal representation, you have a constitutional right to an attorney, even if you can't afford one. The Supreme Court requires states to make sure indigent defendants have adequate representation, and almost all states have complied, with one notable exception, Pennsylvania. It is the one state in the union that provides neither funding nor accountability to ensure that defendants who can't afford a lawyer receive competent representation. The result? Overworked and underpaid public defenders who often have neither the time nor the resources to represent their clients well. And sometimes that means that innocent people go to jail. This is the subject of a five-part Keystone Crossroads series airing on WHYY all this week called No Justice for All, Pennsylvania's Unequal Access to Adequate Public Defense. We will hear in just a few minutes from Phyllis Subin, who is from the Pennsylvania Coalition for Justice, and Rich Long, the executive director of the Pennsylvania District Attorneys Association. But we begin with WHYY's own Kevin McCrory, who is an editor and education reporter for Keystone Crossroads, intimately involved with the series. Kevin, welcome to Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me, Tracy.
So how did this topic become the subject of a five-part Keystone Crossroads series?
We started looking at this a while ago with this report that came out in 2011. The legislature did its own report and said, what is the status of our public defense system? And it was a scathing report that documented all these issues, all these problems, how Pennsylvania is an outlier compared to other states. And we wondered, well, what has happened since then? And so first the question was, has the legislature done anything substantive to address its own report? The answer is no. And so then the next question was, well, they had a lot of data in that report that was based on what happened in 2008. Here we are in 2018, obviously. What's the most recent data set that we can get and analyze and dig into to try to figure out what's changed over time? And we started doing that over a year ago. Emily Previty, our reporter at WITF in Harrisburg, really was the lead reporter to dig into that data. We chose 2015 kind of as our baseline year because that was the most recent we could really feel confident about. And we just dug and dug and dug and dug. But the problem with this system is, as you mentioned, there's no state oversight for the public defense system in Pennsylvania. So if you have a question and you're trying to figure out anything about the system, you really have to go to 67 individual different counties to try to get an answer. And that's what Emily and the rest of the reporters on the team did. We just started going to each individual county, trying to talk to the county officials, the people in the public defender's offices, the people in the district attorney's offices, to try to, you know, piecemeal compile this report, this investigation. And so what we found is that, you know, compared to 2008 being this baseline where the legislature itself had a scathing list of reasons why the system was failing, essentially, we saw that in that since then, the crime rate's gone down, the criminal caseloads have gone down, but the burden on public defenders statewide has gone up 27%. Wow. So you have them even more burdened than they were at the last serious look at this topic, and that, you know, confirmed with all the things we were hearing anecdotally from people all across the state, that the caseloads are really high. People feel like they cannot focus and give their clients the adequate attention that they deserve. And sometimes there are dire and drastic consequences for this. Yeah. And so one of the things we wanted to do with this series was to not just have this, you know, ivory tower discussion about, you know, public defense and criminal justice in Pennsylvania. We were trying to root it in real people who were truly affected by this. And that's how we ended up finding the story of Crystal Weimer, a woman from Fayette County in western Pennsylvania.
Yeah, and I want to talk about Crystal in just a moment. One thing that you said struck me. You said that crime has gone down, and yet caseloads for public defenders have gone up.
And I can't describe exactly why that phenomenon exists, but you just, you know, see public defenders taking on more caseloads. You know, that could be happening again for a variety of reasons across the state without uniform data, without uniform oversight. Some of the answers to these questions just aren't as clear as we would want them to be, but we see the data and that's what it's telling us.
Yeah. And speaking of data, I was reading one of the pieces online that talked about how it's so uneven across the state that some counties have meticulous records. And I read in one case where a public defender said, I'm looking at a scrap of paper from a legal pad with numbers scribbled on it.
Yeah, that was the chief public defender in Schuylkill County. And so Emily Previty was speaking with her and just trying to, you know, ask some basic questions. And she's like, caseload? You're asking me how many cases I've dealt with this year? I couldn't tell you that. I just have random notes here on this legal pad. And then, you know, she gives another example in Berks County of, yes, they do keep track there, and they have a relatively better funded system. But there is this wide disparity, wide inequity across the state. You have some defenders in some counties, you know, who might handle a couple dozen cases a year. You have other defenders in other counties that are handling hundreds and hundreds of cases per year with, you know, 60, 70, 80 cases happening at one time.
And there's no way that you can give full attention when you have dozens of caseloads at the same time to be able to really adequately represent every one of those people.
At least that's what the defenders are telling us. Yeah. And, you know, in one instance, we have a story based in Allegheny County where a public defender there recently left the office, partly because he felt like his caseloads were ballooning to the point that he wasn't giving his clients the representation that he felt they deserved. And in that case, he was particularly upset that the county office was running surpluses every year, which raised the questions of why aren't you putting that money into hiring more people? And he was alleging that the person who, you know, runs that office was connected to the county commissioner, and it was kind of a political thing that was happening there.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned Crystal Weimer just a few moments ago, and she kind of kicks off the whole series. Tell us who she is and why her story is important.
Sure. So she's a woman who was arrested in 2004 for a crime which she was later exonerated for. She was represented by a public defender. She's a single mom of three. She couldn't afford a private attorney. She inquired about that at the outset of her case, was told it was going to cost $50,000. She was not going to be able to afford $50,000. So she went to the Fayette County Public Defender and was represented by them. What was interesting is that in the first phase of her case, the charges were dismissed, and she thought it was over. And her public defender, we point out, could have went and asked for all charges to be dropped with prejudice, meaning that the case would be, you know, basically forever over.
So you can't bring it up again.
Can't bring it up again. That didn't happen. They brought the charges again, and they stuck. And there was, you know, expert testimony in this trial. And long story short, she was sentenced to 12 to 25 years in prison. And she ends up spending about 12 years in prison, where over time she's completely innocent. And she's writing letters and telling people, anybody who, you know, would listen to her story, those facts. And eventually her letters land on the desk of the Innocence Project in Pennsylvania, which is based in Philadelphia. And they go through the case meticulously and basically say, like, look, you know, this expert testimony, is debunked as junk science. This piece of evidence falls apart upon closer scrutiny. Eventually, judge agrees and releases her. But she is collateral damage in this conversation, unfortunately. And now she very much is still picking up the pieces of her life, trying to, you know, reestablish relationships with her children, trying to pull her life back together. Yeah. And you have a situation there where, you know, the public defender who was attached to her case didn't have access to a computer.
Yeah. Wow.
The public defender there, you talk to the chief public defender in Fayette County, and, you know, he knows it. He's like, yeah, we're overburdened. We're always overburdened. What do you expect me to do about that? I mean, he's kind of, in this job for three decades or more and just very hardened to the status quo. And I think you'll hear that in some of the tape we're going to play.
Well, in fact, we do have some sound from the series. I'd love for our listeners to hear this because it gives us a sense of what she's been through.
Crystal Weimer couldn't hire a private lawyer and spent nearly 12 years in prison for a crime she didn't commit. On June 27, 2016, she was exonerated and all charges were dropped permanently.
If somebody would have investigated this crime from the beginning or had the money to hire a private investigator, this injustice would have never occurred.
Now, Weimer is striving for her life to be normal again. But the lasting effects from being incarcerated make that difficult. She has arthritis in her back from lying on a prison bed and struggles with PTSD and anxiety that she might be ripped away from her family again.
you know, for 12 years of my life being away from my family and my three little girls. You know, my oldest daughter is still angry at me, just being without her mom. You can't replace stuff like that. The damage is already done. I can't take it back.
And you were listening not only to Crystal Weimer, but to the voice of Lindsay Lazarsky, who reported that piece in the series No Justice for All, the Keystone Crossroads series. Kevin, I wonder, how many Crystal Weimers are there? How often does this happen that someone who is innocent does time for a crime that they didn't commit because their public defender was not able to give their case the attention that it needed?
I don't have the answer to that question in a solid number. I think that we can confidently say that Crystal's case is somewhat of an outlier in that, you know, she was put to prison wrongly for over a decade on a murder charge. I hope that's not happening as frequently as it could be. But what we know is that there's no one counting, there's no one looking, and there's no one doing oversight to say what's happening at these 67 counties. And to your question, how many Crystal Weimers are there?
How does Philadelphia stack up? And as you looked at these 67 counties and the very uneven distribution of funding, where does Philadelphia fall in all of this?
Philadelphia is considered to be a positive outlier. It's considered to be an office that is very well run and relatively well funded and, you know, takes the issue very seriously, has a lot of cases to deal with, and so is run well. So there's someone in our series who was a former public defender there who said, you know, I loved my boss. I loved my job. I felt like I had a great job, you know, and environment, but I still felt like I was carrying too many cases to really do my job properly. And there's been grumblings in the, you know, defender community in Philadelphia about pay. You know, there's been whispers of, you know, a possible lawsuit to try to force a pay raise. So, you know, I don't want to make it out like it's all sunshine. But comparatively, from what, you know, the 2011 report had shown and what we found anecdotally, it's on probably the better of the curve.
Yeah. Kevin, as you worked on this series and probably found a lot of striking things, but I'm wondering what struck you the most as you and the team unearthed all of this information about how the system works or maybe doesn't work, depending on your perspective. What struck you the most?
You know, realizing just how much of an outlier Pennsylvania is. You know, there's, as you mentioned at the top of the show, Pennsylvania is the only state that doesn't provide any state funding at all to this issue. Other states provide some, and that sum is a very low percentage. Some provide all, and then there's a gradient in the middle. Oversight, though, is probably even more striking to me because essentially, you know, the Supreme Court has said it's up to the states to ensure this Sixth Amendment right that all of us have, as you mentioned at the top of the show. If we can't afford an attorney, we deserve an adequate defense under the U.S. Constitution. Mm-hmm. And the Pennsylvania is just not uniformly making sure that that's happening.
I want to talk about how Pennsylvania has been able to get away with that for so long. When we come back, we welcome your calls as well at 888-477-9499. Radio Times, we'll be right back. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. And if you're just joining us, we have been talking about the fact that Pennsylvania is the only state that does not provide state funding or oversight for its public defense system. And that means that it leaves the job to the 67 different counties. The problem with that is that there are many people who are accused of crimes who are not able to receive adequate defense as required by the Constitution as well as by the Supreme Court. And in some cases, innocent people wind up going to jail. Public defenders are overloaded and underpaid. And Keystone Crossroads has been doing a series on all of this, a five-part series that is airing this week on WHYY and stations all across the state, doing a deep dive into why this is happening and how it's been able to happen for so long. We've been talking with Kevin McCory, who is right here from WHYY. He is a reporter at WHYY as well as for Keystone Crossroads and has been working on this series. Also joining us is Phyllis Subin. Phyllis is executive director of the Pennsylvania Coalition for Justice. And Rich Long joins us as well. He is the executive director for the Pennsylvania District Attorneys Association. Kevin has been here, but Phyllis and Rich, welcome to Radio Times.
Good morning. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good to have you with us. By the way, we welcome your calls, your questions for our guests as we talk about this issue. You can call us at 888-477-9499. You can email us at radiotimes@whyy.org or tweet us at @WHYY Radio Times. Kevin, I want to pick up where I left off with you before we continue our conversation. And we were talking about the fact that Pennsylvania is the only state that has been able to essentially ignore the Supreme Court mandate that states provide some sort of funding. How is it that Pennsylvania has been able to get away with this for so long?
Well, the lead person who's really been rallying for reform in Harrisburg is a Montgomery County Republican named Stuart Greenleaf. And what he'll tell you is, you know, essentially, lawmakers, his colleagues say, they're doing it. They're providing the service that is mandated by, you know, essentially having the counties do the job. And so there is a system. The counties are doing it. But the question he asks is, well, how well? And again, that gets back to the point of we don't know exactly because there's no real oversight. It's kind of similar to, you know, questions in the reporting world that I'm often in education, right? There's this lawsuit that says that school districts aren't living up to this thorough and efficient clause to say that all students are getting this education. And people argue, well, there's a system for education, so then it must be living up to the Constitution. Similarly, in this case, because there's a system, because the counties are indeed doing it, I think that's where this, you know, state leaders would say, look, it's already being done.
Yeah. Before we bring Phyllis and Rich into the conversation, we've got some additional sound from the series. And in this clip, you're going to hear the reporter, Lindsay Lazarski, talking with Crystal Weimer's public defender. We heard from Crystal just a few minutes ago. Would love for our audience to hear this.
To WhiteCo, elected officials' campaign is being tough on crime, so it's just not a priority to increase funding for the public defender's office.
If you have an even playing field, there's going to be winners sometimes in the public defender's office even. And that doesn't bode well for anybody because then their rate goes down as far as their conviction rate.
So the person that's really hurt is the person who's
being represented? Right. But that's a small person in the vast scheme of things.
Kevin, I'd like you to comment on that.
Just very striking in the fact that there's a person who's been doing this job for 30 years and, you know, fully saying, hey, an individual who might be hurt in this situation is a small person in the vast scheme of things.
Yeah. Phyllis Subin, I'd like to bring you into the conversation. I know that you have been listening to some of what we have been talking about here, and I'm curious to hear your take on this and how it is that Pennsylvania is the only state that does not provide oversight and accountability for this.
Well, thank you. First, I'd like to just say that I think the public defenders play a very important role in our communities. It's not just representation of adults and juveniles who are charged with criminal acts. We also provide representation in mental health hearings, in a broad range of representation of adults and children in courts involved in dependency and neglect and abuse. The representation is really much broader than just the representation in the criminal arena. And that's one of the reasons why the caseloads have continued to go up. There also is legislation, for instance, right now in the Pennsylvania House that would require both the district attorneys and the public defenders to represent people in extreme risk protection order proceedings that would allow law enforcement and family members to seek a order to prohibit or to take away a gun or weapons from someone who may be dangerous to themselves and others. And yet in that bill, there is no funding to support either the prosecution or the defense in the representation in those services. And that's what we've seen throughout. There's no voice in the legislature to really bring to the legislature's attention what are the actual cost impacts, both to the prosecution and to the defense, of all of the bills that they are in fact promoting. And while the prosecution has folks like Rich and the District Attorney's Association in Harrisburg, there's no statewide voice on behalf of the Indigent Defense Delivery System. And I've had the privilege of visiting and assessing public defense systems across the country. And when we see that there is a public defender voice and accountability in the state capitol, it brings to the attention of legislators important information that I think they need to consider in terms of what are the actual outcomes of the bills that they are passing in terms of services and costs. And I'll also mention one last thing. According to the Pennsylvania Innocence Project, so far there have been 68 exonerees in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. And obviously the work of the Innocence Project continues to move forward.
Yeah. Rich Long, I'm sorry, Kevin.
Just as a point of information with what Phyllis was saying, when I was talking about caseloads throughout this conversation so far, I was referring to adult criminal cases. And her point is very true, that there's way more that public defenders are taking care of. And that is not reflected in any of the data that we were able to get uniformly, which, again, speaks to the drawbacks of a system that does not have uniform data and standards.
And explains why the caseloads are going up, even as perhaps the crime rate is going down.
But they're even higher if you count those other things.
If you add in all the other issues.
Adult criminal cases there. Yeah.
Rich Long, you represent the Pennsylvania District Attorneys Association. How does your organization view this issue?
Well, I appreciate that last clip that you played. We talked about you know, the public defender was opining as to why he felt that, you know, there wasn't a push for more funding. And I thought that presented a fundamental misunderstanding of the role of the prosecutor. And, you know, our role as prosecutors is to seek justice and make sure justice is served in the courtroom. And so our position is we want a vigorous, well-funded defense. You know, we want a good defense for anyone that's charged with a crime, because our job is to make sure that that individual's rights are protected, and that you know, when they are prosecuted, that it's done properly and with a good defense. So, you know, we don't oppose additional funding for public defenders. We just believe that there needs to be a better, more comprehensive analysis as to you know, what are the issues and what are, if any, disparities. So, you know, what are the actual caseloads in from county to county? You know, how many are homicide cases? How many are rape cases? How many are retail thefts? How many are drug cases? How many result in jury trials? And we haven't seen a study. And I think Kevin touched on kind of the lack of a comprehensive study as to what the issues are, because our position is as well that prosecutors are laboring under financial constraints as well. And, you know, there are high caseloads on the prosecutorial side as well. And, you know, salaries could be higher for prosecutors as well. So that issue is on both sides of, you know, both with public defenders and with district attorneys.
So I would like to, I'm going to be a bit of a troublemaker here.
Sure.
Phyllis and Rich. But I want to bring up a quote from Phyllis, and this is part of the Keystone Crossroads series. And Phyllis, I am quoting you here, where you said, to some extent, DAs don't want a good PD because they're going to start losing. I don't mean to be flip, but things move more seamlessly for them when things are just a plea factory. So, Phyllis, A, are you standing by that? And then I'd like to have Rich respond to that.
I am standing by that. We've seen too many instances where, because of the overwhelming caseloads, lawyers meet their clients at a misdemeanor court hearing for the first time, talk to the client, offer the plea. And as Crystal Weimer's own story on your report indicates, there was a great deal of pressure initially put on her to enter a guilty plea. And in fact, because she knew that she was innocent, she refused to do so. I think the other thing that folks need to know is that we've had numerous studies in Pennsylvania in terms of looking at the indigent defense system. We've had both the constitutional default report from the Joint State Government Commission, and just this past June, we've had another report on capital punishment in Pennsylvania, which really called attention to the disparity in the representation of clients in capital cases and the need to have a capital indigent defense system that really provides high-quality representation so that taxpayers do not pay the cost of having to do retrials when cases are sent back, either by the state appellate court or by the federal court. And the other thing that I think is important to recognize is that the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, in an important decision 2 years ago called Curran versus Luzerne County, Justice Weck recognized that public defender offices are both understaffed and underfunded. And I think that that was a really critical finding. And in fact, the court went on to say that if the appropriate burden of proof is made, people can sue the county before the case goes to trial, arguing that there is such a level of systemic underfunding and understaffing that they would be denied their right to a fair trial. So we have the Supreme Court, our legislature, and outside studies from the American Bar Association to the RAND Corporation, all pointing to the fact that there really is a severe systemic issue in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
You've given us a lot to talk about there. I do want to circle back to Rich. And Rich, I'd like you to respond to Phyllis's statements.
Well, and, you know, Phyllis notes that she comes off sounding flip, and I mean, she's right, because I know she's an experienced public defender, and to characterize prosecutors as seeking or be or happy with if they're, you know, accepting the proposition that public defenders are, you know, underpaid and understaffed and under-resourced, you know, that prosecutors want that because that makes it easier for them. I think that's a fundamental mischaracterization of the role of a prosecutor and how prosecutors see their justice-seeking function. So, you know, I reject that out of hand. And again, that implies that money equals quality, and that's not the case either. In Crystal's case, you know, if there was state oversight or additional staffing, whatever, you know, the issue that's been raised here is that the public defender failed to move to have the charges dismissed with prejudice. Okay, and a judge would have to either accept that or reject it. So it wasn't a done deal, even if the public defender had submitted that. But what level of oversight would change the fact? I mean, some public defenders are better than others. Some prosecutors are better than others. Some private counsel are better than others. But I know from my time as an assistant district attorney in Dauphin County that when I went into court against a public defender, more times than not, that public defender was better prepared and better able to defend their client than the private counsel that I faced in many cases. So I think there's a perception that if to hire private counsel is going to get you a better defense. And frankly, in many, many cases, that is not the case, because the public defender has more experience, they're in court more often, they have a better understanding of the judges and the prosecutors, and they become specialists instead of a criminal defense, a private counsel who oftentimes is also doing wills or family law or other or business law. So, you know, I think there's a, I think it's important to see there are a lot of factors at play here, but certainly prosecutors are not looking to have the defense fight with one hand behind its back. That's not what we're seeking. We want justice for everyone, and you only get that with an adequate defense.
Well, and fair point. And to your point about funding, though, Rich, what about that public defender who's got 80 or 90 or 100 cases and finds it difficult, to put it mildly, to be able to really give representation? In this series, there are people who say, you know, I had a public defender who didn't know my name, or, you know, didn't know anything about the case until we were on the way to the courthouse, or didn't show up because they were so overwhelmed and missed, you know, my hearing. What about them?
Again, some of that, I would say that individual, you know, that there are individual attorneys, some are better than others. I can't speak directly to an individual, a specific case. I mean, prosecutors labor under the same heavy caseloads. And so we, you know, again, we're happy to participate in an analysis of caseloads and and resources. And I know we started off at the top of the show talking about, you know, how Pennsylvania is an outlier. I think it's important also for people to realize that while there's not state-level funding for public defenders, there is still government funding or taxpayer funding through the county system. And basically, you know, the concept there is that that funding is closer to where the actual money is being spent. There goes, it should be more responsive to the needs of that community.
Yeah, right. So your point is...
I don't think that that's really a critical issue, because I've visited many states that have 100% legislative funding for a statewide indigent defense system, which totally accommodates the local needs and the local cultures, which are really important. But I think the more critical issue here is the fact that there are no statewide standards that really define what is effectiveness for public defenders. Standards that do involve caseload controls, standards that involve what are best practices in terms of particular cases. One of the critical things certainly is the extent in which there is training in a much more pervasive way. And I think the Defender Association of Philadelphia really stands out. I was 14 years their director of training, and we really had a philosophy, training never stopped, and it was very hands-on from the moment that a new lawyer walked into the office. But what I hear from chief defenders across the Commonwealth is it's not just the question of the caseloads for the lawyers. It's a question of their being under-resourced in terms of support staff, investigators. The American Bar Association says that a lawyer has a duty to investigate all of the cases.
Phyllis, I'm going to ask you to hold that thought. Yeah. We've got to take a quick break. Hold that thought. We'll continue the conversation when Radio Times comes right back. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. If you're just joining us, we are talking about the fact that Pennsylvania is the only state that does not provide state funding or oversight for its public defense system. In other words, the job is left to the 67 different counties to handle things as they see fit. And sometimes that creates problems where public defenders can be very much overworked and unable to give their full attention to all of the cases that they're handling. In some cases, people who are innocent go to jail or minimally don't get the kind of representation that they are entitled to by the Constitution as well as by a Supreme Court mandate. So that's what we've been talking about. Our guests are Kevin McCory. Kevin, of course, is our own reporter here at WHYY. He has been very much involved with the Keystone Crossroads series, and you have heard him report on educational issues as well. Also joining us is Phyllis Subin. Phyllis is executive director for the Pennsylvania Coalition for Justice, and Rich Long, who is the executive director of the Pennsylvania District Attorneys Association. When we left off before the break, Phyllis, you were finishing a thought. I want you to finish what you were saying and then want to bring Kevin back into the conversation. Go ahead, Phyllis.
This thought goes to what Justice Weck's comment was in the current case, recognizing that public defender offices are understaffed in terms of support staff, paralegals, investigators that fully support the role and the work of the lawyer so that the lawyers can spend more time with their clients and in court. And that is a funding issue and a resource issue that we see pervasive around the Commonwealth. While the prosecutor has full use of a broad range of law enforcement services, the defenders need to be able to investigate their cases, and that's one reason why we need more investigators. We have frequently, as defenders, have to go to the court to ask for experts to fund what are necessary expert testimony and DNA and other kinds of cases. So while there is some state or some county funding, it really is under-resourcing our public defender offices. And I think that's some of the frustration that you hear in the voice of the chief defender in Fayette County.
Yeah, I just wanted to add, I really appreciate Rich making the point that, of course, there's a diversity of people who have skills and talents that, you know, are all up and down the chain. I think that we would point out also that in Crystal's case, it was more than just that, you know, prejudice appeal. There was many facets of her case over the years that probably could have been handled better. And then once the Innocence Project stepped in, they were able to prove that in court. And I guess I would also say that, you know, the chief defender in Fayette County himself counseled us and counsels the people that he comes across and says, listen, if you can hire a private attorney, do it, because you're going to get better attention. Mm-hmm. So the fact that somebody in that position of power is saying that, I think that says something.
Yeah. We've got a couple of questions from our listeners, and I'll get to those in just a moment. But Rich, I do want to ask you about funding, because that was something that you brought up. And one of the things that I learned as I have been listening to this series is that there is this sense in which organizations, grassroots and otherwise, are willing to help raise funds to fight crime, that no one wants to be seen as being soft on crime. And so there tends to be greater funding on the prosecutor side than on the public defender side. I'd like you to speak to that, if you would.
Well, we don't, as an association, and we don't pursue private fundraising. I mean, our training and education efforts are funded through grants that, you know, generally through obtained through the federal government and some through the Commonwealth. And some of those grants have equal amounts that are dedicated then to defense. Now on the defense side, you have organizations, you know, like such as the Juvenile Law Center, the Defense Institute, the Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, the Innocence Project. You know, you have organizations that do provide funding, and in the case of often, you know, capital cases, you know, you have the federal defenders that have you know, resources that outweigh anything that a prosecutor's office can bring to bear in Pennsylvania. And so, you know, there it kind of flips when you're talking about capital defense, especially at the appellate stage. Phyllis mentions the Karen case out of Luzerne County, and you know, they recognize a cause of action for a county, you know, for defendants to say, hey, our county public defender's office is underfunded, and that decision has been out there for 2 years, and you know, I'm not aware of any active suits along those lines that are currently in the courts where defendants in a county are claiming in court that their office, you know, they're getting an inadequate representation because of the resources or lack of resources in their office. So I just, I would anticipate seeing some of those actions, but I'm not aware that we've seen any as of yet.
Yeah. And Tracy,
I think issues is that the Curran was remanded to Luzerne County for litigation, and it's still ongoing, and the retrial. And I think many people are waiting to see that. I think the issue that Rich raises regarding federal funding, one of the problems has been that there is no purpose area in many of the federal grants for indigent defense services. There's been some change in that and modification under the Obama administration. We've yet to see how the Sessions Justice Department will change those purpose areas that might be inclusive of indigent defense. But as far as I know, none of the organizations that Rich talked about are providing direct trial resources. And a capital case costs a lot of money for both a prosecution and for the defense. And I think that's why the capital punishment in Pennsylvania report that came out in June recognized that there is a need for a statewide defense organization to provide uniform representation, which in the long run would save both the DA and the taxpayers money if the case was tried right the first time around.
And Tracy, I think your question actually went to a story that we have coming out a little later this week. Really interesting story out of Blair County, where you've seen the effects of the opioid crisis maybe particularly hitting hard compared to some of the other parts of the state. And with this series, we really did want to try to reflect a diversity of opinion and thought on all this. And we centered the story around this guy who started this nonprofit, essentially, because he was trying to crack down on some of the crime that was coming with the association of the opioid crisis. And so he's been able to raise, you know, $4 million over the past few years. And what that money's been able to do is fund law enforcement and actually very specifically fund a drug prosecutor in the DA's office. And you have plenty of people in the county who say this has been a great thing. You know, we're taking care of the crime that's, you know, associated with these drug problems in a more serious way. But at the same time, you have people in the public defender's office saying, well, look, now you have the cops and the DA pursuing this crime so much more aggressively, but we have no more funding to keep up with what they're doing. And from their point of view, maybe it's criminalizing addiction as opposed to, you know, and people should be getting treatment as opposed to being put in jail. So that's kind of another interesting part of the series that we have coming later this week.
I want to go to a question from one of our listeners. This is a question that was emailed in from Josh. He says, if the state doesn't provide oversight or funding, it's left to the county. Is there any data that shows counties that provide more funding have fewer convictions? If there are fewer convictions, there are fewer incarcerations. Does that mean good public defense saves the state money in the long term? So, Phyllis, I'll let you start off, and anyone who wants to weigh in on that question.
I think that the point of good public defense saves the state money and saves the county taxpayers' money is an appropriate point. One of the things that is certainly happening is interest in reforming the bail system. One of the things that we know is that if a defendant is out on bond and working and supporting his family and less likely to reoffend and help the case, the outcomes may well be different. But I think that there's no real data. And again, without statewide oversight that would provide support and funding so that we can achieve the data mechanisms that the email alludes to, I think we will continue to have the problem. And that's another reason why we need some form of state funding and state oversight so we can pull all of this together and know whether or not we really have accountability and whether or not the outcomes are consistent with what the email question poses.
Yeah, I will say, Tracy, that at the outset of our investigation, our reporting, we wanted to be able to figure that out. What can we tie, you know, what's happening on the budget level and the staffing level to something in case outcomes? And we just couldn't do it. The data is not there to do it, so we didn't make any mention of that in the series.
Yeah, it's just not there as it stands. A couple of other things that I want to talk about, and one is, you know, what is working? And I think, Kevin, you and the team have explored that in the Keystone Crossroads series, that there are being steps taken. Certainly Phyllis's organization is doing some things. You know, Rich's organization is on top of this. But you also explored some efforts that are underway to try to fix this on some level.
Well, there's certainly the legislative fixes that have been proposed and really don't seem to be going anywhere. So we did, you know, talk to the lawmakers about that whole issue. I think that you see defenders' offices getting creative at the county level, trying to make this work for themselves. I think many of them have long ago given up the idea that there's going to be some statewide fix. For instance, we do profile a program in Philadelphia later in the series, where the Philadelphia Public Defenders Association started this thing called participatory defense, which essentially says, you know, if you're arrested, you're not so familiar with the criminal justice system, with the court system, we're just going to help you understand what that process is, how to best represent yourself, how to write your own bio, how to tell your own story, how to make yourself look like a person who's worthy of redemption. So that was, you know, kind of a positive story in our series of a program that's very grassroots, very community-based, that's helping people navigate the system on their own.
How effective has that been so far?
It's new. It's only been around for a year or so, so there's not a lot of, again, hard data on the outcome of that. But anecdotally, the people that we talked with, you know, say it's really making a difference.
Yeah. Phyllis, what are you seeing? Are you seeing programs like that where there are, you know, grassroots groups, community groups who are trying to address this issue?
I think there are a number of really positive things going on. One has to do with the expungement of records, both for adults and juveniles. Efforts by public defender offices to file expungement petitions so that the records are clear and so people can go and enter schools or obtain jobs. That's one area. Another area has to do with bail reform and creating a fair bail system. In Philadelphia, the current DA, Mr. Krasner, has spoken about that. Just yesterday, the ACLU of Pennsylvania issued a press release and sent a letter to the president judges of the Common Pleas and Municipal Court, pointing out areas where they see disparity between those who are wealthy and can pay bail and be released and those who are poor and cannot afford to pay bail and stay in jail, while there may be mechanisms to monitor them and to keep them from reoffending in the community. And there are many advocates in terms of making a fair bail system across the Commonwealth. So those are two areas that I would point to initially.
Yeah. Kevin, you mentioned a little while ago Senator Stuart Greenleaf and that he has been working almost by himself on this issue legislatively. He's slated to retire in the not-too-distant future. Is there anybody on deck to pick up the mantle with this?
Well, his son's running for his seat, so I don't know what's going to happen with that exactly. I would say the other person who's really been out forward lately on this is State Senator Sharif Street from Philadelphia. He and Greenleaf have been doing criminal justice events together, trying to make a lot of these issues more known. But yeah, I think that is an open question. That is how Greenleaf poses it at the end of the story that is published today on Keystone Crossroads, saying, I don't know who's going to pick up the mantle. I don't know who's going to fill that void. So, yeah, I don't have the answer either.
Phyllis, the ACLU has been involved to varying degrees in all of this. In fact, it was mentioned in one of the Keystone Crossroads pieces, their involvement in Allegheny County. I also learned that the ACLU has threatened to sue the state of Pennsylvania to force an overhaul of the criminal justice system. And I'm curious why that hasn't happened already.
Well, I think that one of the reasons is that there are limited resources, and the ACLU has been, as you point out, not only active in Allegheny County, but the ACLU has been extremely active in Luzerne County in representation of the former public defender in federal court, and they are the moving representational experts in the current case that is been remanded. I can tell you that I've been in Montana and I've been in Idaho and other states where the ACLU continues to play an important role in trying to create a fair justice system by adequately funding and staffing the indigent defense representation system in those states. So I think that there still is a way at the ACLU continues to play a major role in Pennsylvania. And I also believe that the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania has to play a major role, too, because ultimately the court is responsible also for assuring that the Sixth Amendment right to counsel, which is contained also in the Pennsylvania state constitution, is effectively delivered in all counties.
I've got to stop you there. We are out of time. Kevin McCrory, Phyllis Subin, Rich Long, thank you all so much for being with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. You have a great day.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
You have been listening to Radio Times on WHYY. You can go to WHYY.org, Radio Times, to download a podcast of the show. We want to thank our engineer, Adam Stanishevsky. The show is produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Tracy Matisak, filling in for Marty Moscowane. Thanks so much for joining us on Radio Times.